Now, Helena, Ladakh is a province of India. It's located in the Western Himalayas. Some people may not know of it. I guess it's been referred to sometimes as a Shangri-La kingdom, even. How did you come to spend time in Ladakh, and what drew you to spend time there?
Well, actually, I was working as a linguist in Paris. I'm sort of Swedish, English, German, and had ended up studying languages and linguistics. And I was asked to go out as part of a film team to this remote, completely unheard of region. It's a part of Tibet, really, culturally. And I was quite interested, but I hadn't known anything about it before, so I just went along to help do the sound in the film, and very importantly, they wanted someone who could pick up a little bit of the language to help facilitate making the film. And that was because the whole area had been closed off completely to the Western world, and so it was really unknown and mysterious. And when I arrived there, I just found, yes, a type of Shangri-La. I really did. I found a place that was far wealthier than anything I had seen in the so-called Third World. And most importantly, I found people who were more self-respecting and joyous and full of vitality than any people I'd encountered. And I had traveled quite a lot. So I fell in love with the place and then decided to stay to work on the language.
When you say wealthier, I guess you don't mean in material wealth necessarily.
I do mean in material terms. I mean both in spiritual, psychological, and material terms. They were far wealthier than what I had seen in the so-called Third World. And I mean, I arrived and found that the houses were large and often three stories high, painted white, beautiful architecture. The women had exquisite jewelry, gold, silver, pearls, coral, turquoise, all of which showed real wealth because that had been traded with from the outside. The people hadn't known hunger. They'd never heard of anyone dying of hunger in living memory. So that is a material standard of living that was far higher than I had thought possible without modern Western industrial progress. So it completely changed my thinking about the world and about poverty, about where it comes from, and it also gave me a glimpse into a possibility of structuring our economic development in a way that would allow more people to have really rich lives, both materially, socially, and spiritually.
I was looking at your book again, Ancient Futures, and there's a quote in there from Major Gompertz, writing in 1928 in Magic Ladakh, "I wonder Mr. Gandhi did not go up to Ladakh. He would have found here nearly all his heart craves." And yet you were amazed at how life could be sustained in such an extreme climate, a very barren land, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, this is what makes it even more remarkable. People had adapted to an ecosystem that I think we could say is probably one of the harshest, most difficult environments in the world. A desert at about 12,000 feet elevation, surrounded by high mountains, snowed in for 6 to 8 months of the year. And in this barren, cold desert, people had, I suppose, had to learn that resources have limits and that we prosper if we learn to really look after those resources and work with them rather than squandering them. So, yes, I think what I found was something that was very, very close to Gandhi's ideal of relatively self-reliant villages. And yet, for me, it's also fascinating to see that there was trade. I mean, there was trade at every level, you know, within the village, between villages, in regional trade. But I think the big difference was that it was on the terms and in the hands of the local people rather than either huge anonymous governments or big corporations.
I'm interested in the aspect of daily life there. You were noticing a lot of interdependence, weren't you? A lot of harmony.
That's right. I mean, it can sound incredibly romantic, and so I really, I I find it very hard to really express it in a way that does it justice and that doesn't, you know, leave people with the idea that these people were some kind of angels or saints. They weren't. The more I live there, and now I have been going back for 30 years, and I've seen huge changes with the advent of the modern economy and so on, and I think I do have a pretty clear perspective. Obviously, it can't be totally objective. But yes, what I saw was that in that way of life, reciprocity and helping one another was so clearly something that was mutually beneficial. So it wasn't actually altruism in the sense of helping someone without any sense of having it returned. Because people were living in more community structures and had long-term relationships with each other, I saw that they were, you know, they realized that helping the other was the same as helping themselves, that in one way or another it would return. It wasn't sort of tit for tat, you know, immediately, you know, I help you out and then you've got to help me out. But there was that knowledge that you were living in a community where you would get help when you needed it. And it was it was absolutely wonderful to see how well it worked. I suppose particularly what strikes me, you know, when I look at how many Westerners in my sort of lifetime, how many people I've known who've dreamed of living in smaller villages, closer to the land and with community. I think one of the things that we weren't aware of was the need to have a critical mass of people. And what I mean by that is, you know, there were a lot of people who moved out into communes, communities, eco-villages, with too small a number to really fulfill all the various tasks that are needed. And it became very hard. Whereas what I found in Ladakh was that something like growing grain, enough grain to last you for the entire year, and so you even had stockpiles of it and you could make lots of beer out of excess grain and so on, it's actually very, very easy if you have the right ratio of people involved at the peak seasons. And the actual planting season and then harvest season are relatively short. But at that point, you need lots of help and lots of labor. And Ladakh has got that through institutions of collaboration and exchange. You know, they actually had sort of network structures of relationships that meant that they shared that labor and made it easier for everybody.
One of the things that seemed to have impressed you most over your 16 years there was just how the country changed. You said that you were there when the country started to open up, and I guess you were there to witness that firsthand, weren't you?
That's right. Actually, you say 16 years because that was at the time that I wrote the book, Ancient Futures, but of course now I've been there for 30 years. The sort of opening up of change to the outside world really started almost as I arrived. You know, I was one of the first outsiders to visit the region. And I think if I hadn't learned to speak the language fluently, relatively quickly, I probably wouldn't be saying, I wouldn't have realized a lot of things that I did through speaking the language fluently. Because in doing so, I can really say that in the early years, I experienced people who had the most remarkable high level of self-esteem, tolerance of others, which I now realize were linked. If you have self-respect and if you've grown up feeling really loved and supported as a child, you develop a tolerance and security and even love for yourself that allows you to be more tolerant and loving and accepting of others with all their frailties and problems. And I saw very, very clearly how the pressures from the outside had a psychological impact of making people feel insecure, making the young in particular feel inferior, feel that their way of life was somehow primitive and backward, and this mythical Western world was one of constant glamour and leisure, infinite wealth. It was so powerful and so seemingly successful that people lost respect for their own way of doing things, as I say, particularly the young. And I, so those psychological changes I saw happen in a very dramatic way. And I saw that with that loss of respect for their own culture, for their own knowledge systems, for their own everything, their own language, their own clothing, their own architecture, I saw that that rejection came out of this sense of inferiority. So I think that has made also the work that I've been doing there quite unique, because we've been working to try to redress that really mistaken notion that the West is perfect and that we have nothing but leisure and wealth and, you know, everything is perfect. Because that image of perfection is what makes other people feel imperfect. So I realized there was a huge information gap and that I could play a role in providing a fuller picture of what development had brought to other parts of the world, and particularly I could bring information about what was going on in the West.
Are all types of development, though, necessarily bad? I mean, do you argue against technological change?
No, you see, what people really don't understand is that today we have got but one model of development. And I think that 99.9999% of the activity that goes on under the name development is actually very destructive. And it's in part because it is everywhere contributing to the creation of a consumer monoculture that is so unsustainable and so unjust that it's leading, literally everywhere in the world, is leading to a dramatic widening in the gap between rich and poor. And I mean everywhere. I mean in my native country of Sweden, I mean in Mongolia, I mean in Ladakh, every country. You won't be able to name a single country where the gap between rich and poor isn't widening. Now, that is not an inevitability. And it's not some kind of natural phenomenon. It's not some kind of evolutionary process. It's because of very specific institutions having global reach. And I'm talking now in particular of the World Bank, the IMF, and the trade treaties. The GATT was one of the earlier forms of this, and now with the World Trade Organization. And this process is being pushed by the US government and the UK government. That process is leading to one form of development everywhere. Having said that, I reject completely this one dominant form of development does not mean that I'm opposed to development, to technological change, to cultural change, to changes in ecosystems. What I think we need to understand is that the flowering and maintenance of diversity is essential for life to continue, for real sustainability. So what I am working for is the understanding of how we can create the structures that would allow for a development that comes from within, that comes on the terms of different cultures, different peoples, different regions, that builds on what's there, that uses local resources and finds ways of improving on them. I get so excited when I realize that nowhere in the world for the last 500 years has development been based on actually enriching and truly developing what is in a particular area. It's been the opposite. It's been a draining and a loss. What I mean by that is that the fundamental principle behind development is something called the principle of comparative advantage. And the dominant assumption then in economic development has been that it's in the interest of every region and community to specialize their production for export instead of maintaining a diversity of knowledge, skills, and products from the region that would be there to feed and clothe and house themselves as a priority, and then have trade as a secondary level of importance. Once one has satisfied basic needs at home, you trade the excess. This was all turned on its head with slavery, with people coming in from the outside, forcing people away, from producing a whole range of things for themselves. You know, whether you were growing barley in Tibet or rice in Thailand, as well as creating fibers for clothing, materials for buildings, you were pushed away from that and put into a field to produce just cotton for the West, or whole regions becoming tin countries, coffee countries, banana regions, in order to supply the global market with a particular product. Now, that was actually an impoverishment for the majority. Of course, in slavery, no one can deny that that created poverty. But what we don't look at is how that's the fundament of the modern economy. And that assumption that you don't diversify, in other words, you do not emphasize a development which would say, okay, well, what could you grow in this region that would provide healthy, fresh food for the majority of people from closer to home? How would you use the local climate, local resources, to ensure that people have beautiful, gracious, sustainable homes that are not full of toxic chemicals and using materials made by a few multinational corporations? How would you ensure that fiber for clothing can be healthy, organic, sustainable? Now, that model of development would mean respecting the diversity and realizing that in some regions you might have flax, in other regions you might have cotton, another area hemp. I mean, actually hemp can grow in an awful lot of ecosystems. But what we have instead is a petroleum-based development where basically plastic clothing, plastic building materials, plastic food in effect, I mean, that means food using huge amounts of petroleum, in terms of the machinery, the transport, the processing, that's what's being imposed everywhere, standard monoculture.
It seems, though, that there just isn't the conscience, the willingness to be receptive to what you're saying. Development is gathering apace. We've now got British companies setting up call centres in India. What next?
Yeah, I mean, it's just unbelievable that if you ring now in Britain to get the train times, you know, someone answers you in Bangalore. And this is a really insidious form of slavery. It's modern slavery where these people are told they have to sound as though they're in Britain. They have to watch British soap operas. They have to keep up with what's happening in Britain. But of course, for the individuals who get those jobs, it can be seen as a good thing because they're not being given very many other options. That doesn't mean, however, if we sit down together, Indians and British people together, to look at what would really serve both our needs, we would come up with a different model. So yes, the dominant model, which is absolutely unsustainable at the moment, is based on a globalizing economy where giant multinational corporations are merging into becoming even more large and powerful, and the people who work within those corporations are faced with essentially with bankruptcy if they do not rush around the world looking for the cheapest labor. Now, in the meanwhile, we have a financial system and a banking system that's keeping the value of currencies at very unjust levels. And we have a system that means the whole thing is based on debt, so that governments are indebted to banks, which forces them to constantly push further in this direction. So we have to look at it more holistically and realize that the current system really is a lose-lose economy where there are no real winners. As the CEO of one of the biggest corporations in the world, you are still threatened with sort of vultures all around you that are going to take over, with shareholders that are pushing you just to look at the narrow profit margin. And you're under such intense pressure these days. I mean, the sort of average CEO really is working 80 hours a week or more. It's not fun for anybody, this. You know, you might get a nice big fat salary, but you ask those people about how much they're enjoying their quality of life, how much time they have for their children, what they feel about the future for their children. People are very worried. I don't think you will find very many individuals who would say that they have a lot of time. Now, sadly, most people don't look at that from a more global point of view. They tend to see things in a very individualized way, and they tend to think it's their own fault that they don't manage their time well. The average doctor today has far less time with each patient than they did even 10 years ago. The average teacher, the time that they can spend, quality time with each student, has deteriorated dramatically. In both cases, both the doctor and the teacher have to spend far more time on bureaucratic paperwork, but they also have to have a bigger throughput. The ratio between doctor and patient and between teacher and student is deteriorating. Now, it's a general pattern where the centralization of economic activity and an artificial scarcity of jobs is making those who have jobs work harder and have to have a bigger throughput. And then there are many more who don't have jobs at all. And so I think the key is not to demonize individuals, not to demonize those in positions of power, but to understand the structures better, the processes, the structures, and to realize these circular interactions that feed the same system. And then to look at how we as individuals, communities, and nations can stop fueling and feeding a system that's killing us. And it's beginning to happen, but it needs to happen more and more rapidly.
Standing at the threshold, anything could happen now. I dream of all the inspiration that I've read about. Waiting at the threshold with a true heart and open arms, I'll make all of the sacrifices that are needed to keep you from harm. Gaia, my beloved, you are everything to me, and I will always protect you. Gaia, my beloved.
What kind of personal decisions might we be needing to question?
I think there are lots of things that we can do as individuals right now that will improve the quality of our lives, and that will also give more meaning to our lives. But I think one of the first things, again, that I would emphasize is this education and information process. I think we need to think of education as activism. And I'm now talking about adult education, and I'm talking about starting with ourselves to find the materials that will look at this big picture of what's going on around the world, what's really going on. In my organization, ISEC, we've put together a curriculum that we call Roots of Change. And we encourage people to get together in their local community with friends. You know, rather than going to some anonymous meeting hall and dealing with people they don't know, just start with friends and neighbors and people you enjoy spending time with. But decide, you know, in addition to maybe meditating or singing or cooking and eating together, let's also spend some time trying to understand what's going on in the world. Of course, the problem is a lot of people think they know that, but I maintain that what we get in the mainstream media and what we get through mainstream education doesn't actually give us an accurate picture. So you have to look for materials that come from different sources, and that can be quite hard work. And so that's why we put together a curriculum or sort of, you know, articles from around the world. And we found that a lot of people who do this, who meet as a group, it's very empowering, because then the question becomes more, what can we do rather than what can I do? I think in the 80s and 90s, we've been focused too much on trying desperately to recycle some aluminium tins and to drive a bit less and to do this and do that. And, you know, we were told that we were to blame for everything that's wrong in the world. Mounting poverty in the third world, global warming, it was all our fault. That analysis is very, very flawed. It does not tell us how our tax monies are being used to turn us into bigger consumers. It doesn't tell us, doesn't talk about the advertising that targets three-year-old children and makes them insecure, greedy consumers. So we need to look at it in a bigger picture way, because then we can see what we need to do to change it and how we can start right now to help our children get more involved with the local culture, get involved with some of the exciting projects that take them into nature, that support community building instead of competition, that help them find the really exciting alternatives that are out there. Now, one of the most exciting alternatives that I know of is the local food movement, which we have been promoting in my organization for a long time. And it may sound like a very limited thing, but I really can say that when you rethink the economy, number one, what you realize is that there is nothing that human beings produce that every single person on the planet needs three times a day. There is nothing else that everyone needs to have other than food. And yet farming is not there centrally on the agenda, even when economic sort of alternative economists are rethinking the economy. And it should be. Now, when you look at that globally, you find then that farming is actually the fundament of economic activity. And then when you look at making change, you realize that we have a system right now where fresh milk, live animals, bread, biscuits are being shipped in larger and larger quantities back and forth across the entire world. And local food is becoming too expensive for local people. So whether it's in Mongolia or in Devon, you will find that butter from the other side of the world costs less money than local butter. Now, why is this happening? How is this happening? That's part of the rethinking, is understanding that. What you find is hidden subsidies that we don't hear about. Subsidies for transport and trade and petroleum that totally distort the prices and that make fresh local food too expensive for the majority. What we can do as individuals and as community groups right now is to support the local food movement where we can. Maybe we can't afford to shop at the farmer's market or in the local shop, but we can pass around leaflets, we can write some letters, put in a little bit of our time to help change this madness that makes local food more and more expensive and only something for the elite. And there are many exciting projects now, like getting local food into the schools, linking schools and farms, having even children grow food at school as part of the curriculum. Some of these things are happening more in America than here, but there's a lot happening here, Italy, all over Europe. And so people need to know about that. It's not yet widespread enough in the media, and particularly the central importance of this is not widely enough recognized. Again, in my organization, we created something we call a local food toolkit, which consists of a book we wrote called Bringing the Food Economy Home. And it consists of a cassette from an international conference we organized on this issue, an action pack that gives you a whole range of different things you can do. And we have several other materials in this toolkit.
You've mentioned your organization, ISEC, the International Society of Ecology and Culture. You set up that project some time ago now in Ladakh. What have been the main achievements of it?
Well, I've been working in Ladakh now for many, many years, and I helped to set up the first sort of non-governmental organization there, which was an ecological development group with local Ladakhis. And it was basically leaders who later became the local government. When I first came, they were under the state of Jammu and Kashmir, so there wasn't a local Ladakhi government. But the leaders of this ecology group have now become, many of them have become the leaders in the local government, which is very, very exciting. Before that, for many years, we were working disseminating information, for instance, about the DDT and other outlawed pesticides that the Indian government was bringing into this part of Tibet. We were also demonstrating renewable energy technologies as an alternative to the dependence on fossil fuels that, again, the government was bringing in. We also did a lot of work in trying to raise cultural self-esteem. And that, in part, was based on doing what we called reality tours to the West. I had seen how mythical and completely false impressions about the West, the idea that in the West people don't work, they have infinite leisure and wealth, had affected young people in Ladakh and had made them feel inferior. And so I realized that understanding what was really going on in the West could help to balance these false impressions. So I was able to raise small amounts of money. It was very hard to raise money for, to bring some potential leaders to the West every year. And so this has been going on now for almost 30 years, and it has included all sorts of different reality tours. But the basic thing is that people get a sense to see with their own eyes that there is unemployment in the West, there is dissatisfaction, there are all sorts of breakdown that they don't have yet. Like, for instance, old people's homes where people don't see their grandchildren for a year or sometimes 10 years, which local people from these cultures like Ladakh find very, very shocking. So seeing some of these problems that have arisen here, first of all, that puts a bit of a dent in this idea that we live in a paradise. They also start seeing that, oh yes, we do earn a lot of money, but my goodness, you know, we pay £1 for a cup of tea. Well, that's like a fortune in their currency. So they start realizing that it's not just that we have such big salaries, but we also have big expenses. And then we also, very importantly, put people in touch with the many positive initiatives that are going on in the West. So groups that have been working for years to try to solve the problems of poverty and pollution and build up an organic agricultural movement. And seeing that Westerners are actually working and striving for change is very, very persuasive. That's real evidence that all of us are not so happy with this way of life. So it ends up having quite a big effect, and I think we've really helped to change the consciousness in Ladakh quite significantly. And maybe most excitingly for me, I helped about 10, 12 years ago rural women to get together to strengthen their voice and their values. And they were the sort of cornerstone of this Tibetan Buddhist ecologically based culture, and they were being marginalized very rapidly by conventional development. And for instance, in those days, you know, if they would go into a government office, you know, led by Indian officials and so on, they would be treated like beggar women because they were seen as illiterate and they didn't speak anything but the local language. But helping them to get together has been an amazing, phenomenal thing, because they've become the most powerful movement in Ladakh. Now, with about 7,000 members, they are so respected, partly because they have a very big vote now. And so if they go into a government office now, everyone is bowing and scraping and trying to please them. And so it's very, very exciting to work with that and with them.
You wrote about the changes after being in Ladakh for 16 years. What about the changes after 30 years? And how about some of the people that you've known over that time?
Well, the really, really exciting thing there is that I would say that in the last 5-6 years, the shift in consciousness in Ladakh has made it very exciting to work there. So until about 5-6 years ago, I'd say some of the changes were becoming very, very depressing. in 89, I wrote about that in my book as well, there was violent conflict between Buddhists and Muslims who had lived peacefully side by side for 500 years. There had never been group conflict. But because of the pressures on the young in particular, driving people off the land to look for jobs that were basically non-existent, creating intense competition, suddenly people started fighting each other. So those were pretty depressing times. I mean, I would say around 89, too, I felt that in the Western world there was very little understanding of this. At that time, a lot of people were very excited about the concept of sustainable development. They thought it was really being implemented, and they didn't realize that a lot of that was only talk, sort of window dressing, but fundamentally